Welcome to Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. It's like coffee with an analyst, but there's no actual coffee. Each episode, we interviewed an expert in the field of law enforcement analysis to share their career-defining stories and to get their insights on the world. Please join us on recognizing and learning from these brilliant minds as we define the law enforcement analysis profession one episode at a time.
Thank you for joining me. I hope many aspects of your life are progressing. My name is Jason Alder, and today our guest has 22 years of law enforcement analysis experience. She spent 8 years with the Nashua PD in New Hampshire. She's an instructor with IDALIS, IACA, IACP, NHTSA, TxDOT, and other federal think tanks. She is the founder and CEO of Excellence in Analytics. She's an analyst turned motivational speaker and life coach, here to talk about, among other things, her new book, Bigger Than Data. Please welcome Dawn Reby. Dawn, how are we doing?
Hey, Jason. Thank you so much for having me here today. I appreciate you.
All right. Very good. So assuming your Thanksgiving went well, how was it memorable?
Well, I love when family time happens. I love when it's unique and fun and silly. And so with a year and a half-ish of COVID and not having the ability to really connect, this Thanksgiving is quite amazing and just fun to just see everybody and hug folks and be part of their worlds physically again.
Good. Ours was memorable. My wife was born on Thanksgiving, so she considers the holiday hers. And so we're getting ready for dinner. Everything's ready. And the last thing she's pulling out of the oven is the stuffing. And she drops it, shattering it all over the floor.
Oh, no. Oh, goodness gracious.
And that stuffing is not only one of her favorite Thanksgiving foods, it's one of her favorite foods, period. She was actually baking it in our garage oven, so it fell on the garage floor. So there was no way to salvage the stuffing. So this will be known as the year that we had Thanksgiving with no stuffing.
Oh, gosh. All right. Okay. Poor thing. Well, hopefully she still had a great birthday and hopefully the turkey was good.
Yes. Everything else went well. So, good. All right, good. So how did you discover the law enforcement analysis profession?
Well, you know, when I was in college, I was a young mom, actually, and I was a teen mom. I was 18 years old when I had my daughter 3 days before I turned 19. And I was on this mission to just start my life. And so I was a sophomore in college and working really, really hard and searching for internships left and right. And there was these just wonderful, wonderful professors who linked me in to the Lowell Police Department in Massachusetts. And I had no idea what I was getting into. They said, hey, you know, do you want to earn some credit and do an internship at Lowell? You know, I was like, sure, that sounds great. And it turns out that it was 32 hours a week of unpaid time.
Wow.
And we had to go to a Wednesday class that really talked about our experience. And so it took up a lot of time. And as a young mom, I was like, you know, I got to get my feet into something positive. And so I did. And I loved my experience as an intern. It was a 3-month experience. I met great people. Carol Fitzgerald was, you know, my mentor during that time. And I worked under Commissioner Davis, who is just phenomenal in the analytical field overall. I was truly blessed to be in that particular agency. He went on to be the Boston commissioner. And so he really had these great understandings and ideas of what analytics should be even back in 1998. So a couple of, you know, when my internship ended, I was like, wow, there's this new field. I didn't even know crime analysis existed. And I fell in love with it. They offered me a position, and at the time, you actually needed your master's degree to be a crime analyst. And so they said, if you agree to get your master's degree, we'll agree to hire you. So I agreed, they agreed, and that was it. I got it in much shorter time because they allowed so much flexibility for me, and I'm forever grateful for them. And that really started and ignited all of this.
So when you think back, and I think you're the perfect person to ask this question to.
Yeah.
Think back to when you're walking in to the police department that first week. What did you think success looked like?
Ugh.
And because for me, I think back, this is so horrible answer. Mine was, I walked in and I said, I need to make $47,000 a year. And I'm there like, why $47,000? I had a college buddy who got hired right out of college, moved down to Virginia and made $47,000. So that was the goal that I set for myself, even though he was in Virginia and in IT, not even in the same field. That yeah. was my mindset. And, mm-hmm. and so that was my goal. Like first week, I was like, how do I get there? Right.
And, fantastic.
And I didn't get there till my 30s in Cincinnati, but at least took me a while, but that was my mindset. So what was your mindset then?
Yeah, how fun. That was not my mindset at all.
Well, that's good.
No, I think that's brilliant. I think to walk in with a goal and how do I get there? Like knowing where you're going is so critical. So I love that about you, Jason. So for me, I was a teen mom from Lawrence, Massachusetts, which is kind of when I was there, a very rundown, poor community. And I just wanted a way out. I wanted a way out. I wanted to be somebody different. I didn't want to be on welfare my whole life. I didn't want to be in the WIC line my whole life, in the food stamp line. And I knew that success for me would be getting off of all assistance that I was on. And the only way for me to do that was to position myself well. And that was really my perspective, to learn what I needed to learn, to get paid what I really wanted to get paid, which was anything more than welfare, right, at the time, and to transition off and be able to pay everything I needed to pay for my daughter. Her dad was not involved at the time, so it was 100% on my shoulders to really make this happen, you know, and I also had a moral compass, and I really knew that I loved law enforcement. I wanted to do VICAP and be a lawyer, and all these things were in my head. And so I knew that was going to be the moral compass where I wanted to point, but that was also going to be my ticket out of this lifestyle that I had been accustomed to seeing around me as normalized. So that was that. So my success was get off welfare and pay for everything myself and let my daughter be really proud of her mom.
Nice. See, that was so much better than my answer. No.
Not at all. I love your answer. I love that you see way past what I was seeing in 1998. So that's great that you are who you are.
So when you're getting established, first couple of years, you become an analyst at a police department, and it really can go in multiple different directions, depending on the tasks that you're giving, where you're assigned. What was it like for you? Where were you assigned? What task were you doing? What did you accomplish?
Yeah, so our agency was a little under 300 officers. So we had maybe three or four analysts when I first walked through the door. And we were positioned in this closet. And in order, our desks were, there was, I forget if it was three or four when I first started, but four shortly after that, right? And I had Derek DeRosha there and Carol Fitzgerald there. And then Tommy, our sergeant, was there. And our desks were positioned so closely together that in order for me to get from my desk to the bathroom, Derek had to close his drawers. So it was pretty wild. And then we had this huge plotter that became my office at one point. And that was really a closet. So it was me and the plotter for a while right after being squished in with Derek. But the agency overall, you know, understood analytics even back then. Ed Davis would come. He's probably about almost 7 feet tall. I don't know. He's a pretty large guy, maybe 6.5 feet tall. Anything for me, I'm 5'1", seems ginormous, right?
Yes.
He would come down to our office with Carol, myself, Derek, and our sergeant turned lieutenant, turned captain at some point. And then, you know, the other folks who started to come in, he would come down to the office and he'd say, what do I need to know about my community? And I felt so important.
Wow. Yes.
I was like, what? This ginormous statured individual is asking us what's important. And we would go to these CompStat meetings and he would say, Don, what do you think we should do? Don, Carol, Derek, like, what do you all think? You guys know the information. What do you think? And I never really realized how incredibly lucky we were to have a commissioner, a chief like that, because I've been to hundreds of police agencies at this point, and that is not typical, unfortunately, right? We don't see a lot of that. Maybe 30% of that is true right now in this country. So I really was fortunate to get an internship at an agency that truly valued analytics and the growth of data-driven strategies.
Okay, so let's talk some success stories then. This brings us to your analyst badge story. So this is the career-defining case or project that an analyst works on. What was your analyst badge story?
Yeah, so it's funny because I was thinking about this and it's kind of like this blur, right? of stuff that, you know, you just work on and think about and you get excited and then it's gone the next day, and which is really why I want to just insert, develop a portfolio, jot these things down. You will forget 20 years later.
Yes.
And so get these patch stories down, every single one of them. But one of the ones when I was in Nashua, New Hampshire Police Department in probably like 2008 or 10, something like that, I was the first analyst in the state of New Hampshire. So they recruited me from Massachusetts and they said, we want you to build analytical capacity in the state of New Hampshire. We want you to be our first analyst. And so I worked for an agency with a little under 200 officers. It was tough. It was tough penetrating those walls. I remember some people were like, we don't really trust you. We don't really need you. Mm-hmm. All of that. And so, but I do remember this undercover, eventually, you know, I got in, right? And so at one point there was an undercover narcotics detective. He's sitting in his car. He's on a vehicle. He's looking at this, you know, tan car, whatever color it was. And he reaches out and he's like, Don, I'm sitting on this car. I know it belongs to Maria. There's a male in the vehicle. Is there anything that you can tell me about this male, right? Like, I want to know, am I dealing with a mass murderer? Like, who am I dealing with here? And so at this point, I was a few years in, because I remember it took me 2 years to get access to my data.
Wow.
Yes, and that was, thank you, Christopher Bruce and Deb Peel.
I get mad if it's not there this morning and you waited 2 years.
I waited 2 years to convince everybody that I needed access to data to analyze data.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
But that was early days, 2005. That was a long time ago. So anyway, so I got access to this data and I had worked with my mentors, Christopher Bruce and Deb Peel and Carol, to set up these systems so that I would easily be able to just have data at my fingertips, right? So I had my probation parole data from the state at my fingertips. I had my RMS data, my CAD data, my traffic data. Everything was now at my fingertips and it took years to get it there, but it was now there. And so when this undercover knock says, you know, like, who is this person I'm dealing with? I put out some feelers. New Hampshire borders Massachusetts, right? So we're, you know, maybe, I don't know, 10 minutes from the border where I was physically located. So I put up some feelers to Massachusetts. They have a strong analyst group that I was a part of. And I said, hey, you know, has anyone seen anything that relative to this vehicle, right? And the detective is doing his thing and I'm doing mine, right? So I reach out within a couple of minutes, an old intern of mine, actually, she was an intern at the Lowell Police Department in my early days. And she was now a gang intel analyst for the Fusion Center in Massachusetts. So I sent out the feelers and I said, hey, any of you guys know anything about this vehicle, please get back to me ASAP, right? And analysts have this language with each other that you kind of just know to help each other out, right? So she reaches out and she says, hey, what I can tell you is that there's some intelligence on this car out of Boston, Massachusetts. And I don't know what the intelligence is, like the details. I can just see that there's some information there. She says, call Boston Intel and get some information. So I reached out to Boston Intel about that vehicle and they said that that male, they identified who the male actually was, right, in the vehicle. And they noted that this particular male was arrested in a city about 30 miles out of Boston. The Mass Fusion Center knew that this car got pulled over in Boston. That's what they knew. Mm-hmm. And then the Boston PD said, yes, we pulled over the vehicle. They identified the male. And they said, and we know that he was arrested about 30 miles outside of Boston, which was the community that I grew up in, right? So sure. I reached out to that community, a quick phone call. And luckily, I had attended all of these regional network meetings with this group, right? With Massachusetts group. So I knew the people, I had a relationship with them. So I reached out to this agency. Within a couple of minutes, that analyst was able to share a photo of the guy who was arrested, confirming who he was, along with a ton of intel not just about his arrest, but about, you know, FI's field interrogation reports and similar information that maybe hadn't really reached the arrest report. And so then I was able to pull all that information together and kick it out to the undercover who's sitting on the vehicle in, you know, in no time at all, right? In just a few minutes. And so he was able to really sit back and say, how did you identify this guy who's sitting in this car, Maria's car, give me a photo, give me a write-up of all of this in like 20 minutes, right? Not even, I think it was, about, I don't know. It was definitely under a half hour, maybe even 15 minutes. And I felt like a magician. I was just like, yeah, I got the pull.
Yeah, exactly. I know people.
And it was a really great badge story because people realized, especially the Detective Bureau, realized that Don had all these networks already set up. Crime Analysis had these networks set up that I could retrieve information from. When he tried to contact the same police agencies, nobody returns his call. Right. So now it just really made it and positioned me well to have a success story, to equip this detective with the tools that he needed in that moment, and to really show them that the work of the analyst is to gather this information and provide opportunities for them to succeed. And sure enough, there, I just did it.
It's amazing because networking is so important. There's 17, 18,000 police departments here in the States. Data is siloed all over the place. And it's amazing how much we talk about networking because it should be a given. And yet it seems like some analysts don't do it. And some analysts think it's a waste of time to go to some of these regional meetings and to rub elbows with different people in their jurisdiction.
That was me, Jason, at one point. Yeah. My mindset at one point was, I'm so flipping busy that if you give me one more thing to do, I'm going to break, right?
Yeah.
I was like, I don't have time to talk to people. They talk too much. I need to get my work done. And that is a mistake. That mindset is a mistake. We can build our influence through these relationships, not only in our current agency, right, and in our current agency's needs, but far beyond that. And that really creates the opportunity for analysts to feel less stuck, to feel like they have, you know, few options. In turn, building quality relationships and ensuring that that's part of your role as an analyst is key to higher clearance rates, better analytics, fresh ideas, and potential future jobs and potential future relationships that are going to rock your world, right? So I always encourage analysts to not make the mistake I did in the beginning, which was stay in my office all the time and think that relationships were a waste of time, because they're really not. They really are the crux of what we do.
And so you work your way up at the police department, and you mentioned this in your book. You're in the executive meetings.
Yeah.
And you put in the corner, but you're there.
Yep.
And so how did you go from the analyst with the plotter as a partner all the way up to being in the room for executive meetings?
Yeah. Well, I would say the first thing I did was invested in myself. I think that one of the things that I think is really important is shifting the mindset of law enforcement analysts to not rely on your agency to progress you, to 100% invest in yourself, invest your time, invest your money, invest your spirit in creating your own path, regardless of what your agency will and will not fund. I mean, I've seen people go to conferences and take a week vacation time and pay for themselves. And, you know, it stinks that they have to do that. But the reality is that's the mentality that brings you closer to your life by design, to your success. So for me, that's the first piece, is really deciding that that's what I want. I want to be the person at the table, and my agency is going to take me seriously, and my agency is going to know that I'm providing value. So that first piece of deciding, and then doing something about it, investing in myself. I mean, I educated myself, I read books, I became IACA certified. Anything I could do to professionalize myself and position myself to be one of the folks that they look towards to say, hey, what do we do, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you make that decision, when you show up as your best self, they want what you have to say. when you're meek and timid and you're not confident and you sit in the corner, I mean, I sat in the corner, but you know what I mean? Like when you, people can't really find, like, why should I listen to that analyst? And so I think really deciding that this is what you want to be and how you want your career to look is important. And then creating action steps around getting there is equally important. And demanding it, quite honestly, part of the language that I've had with chiefs, and I've spoken with hundreds of them, part of the language that I have had with them is, you know, these are the best practices. I'm really good at grabbing lots of information and making your job much easier, getting you aware of what you need to be aware of, getting detectives the information that they need, getting patrol the directive that they need. And in order for me to succeed as an analyst, here's what I need from you. I need access to my data, you know, certain equipment to do the thing. I need to be at the executive meetings, participating in a way that's of value to you and to me. And these conversations and these, in a sense, kindly demanding, I think chiefs are looking for this. They want to know what's going to make it work. They don't want to make all the decisions. They want you to step up as a leader, as the CEO of crime analysis, and tell them what needs to happen. Nobody, no leader wants to be doing everything and making all the decisions. They want you to bring the best to the top and say, here's what I believe based on my experience, based on my research, based on my expertise. Here's what I believe is the most effective way to run this or whatever it might be. So deciding and then taking flip and action. Stop waiting for your agency to tell you that we're going to fund you to do this and we're going to fund you to do that. Forget that. Dump it. Get it out of your head. And if they fund you, great. If not, it's your freaking life. It's your career. You know, love yourself enough to step into your power. That's a motto that I live by, is be the CEO of your life, period.
Mm-hmm. You said demanded, but that's the appropriate word, because as you said, a lot of times people won't bring you along. They won't pull you up. I mean, there's certainly situations where they recognize analysts and they either promote them or give them raises and whatnot. It does happen, but you know, in other situations, it may never happen. So you kind of have to make your own way. And so when you're doing the sales pitch to them and you're saying, hey, I need to be in these executive meetings, that's how I'm going to be most effective. Did you also mix in the idea that, did you have to like threaten to leave?
No. Okay. If you walk in with like a list of demands, like that's mm-hmm. not the best approach, right? Mm-hmm. But if you walk in with your research done, if you walk in with an established network of other analysts that you regularly communicate with and discover best practices, if you walk in with their best interest in mind, then, you know, then having these conversations don't have to be just once. You know, you can have a relationship building strategy, I suppose we could say it like that, where you're saying to yourself, how do I create buy-in? How do I create influence? How do I make it so that I'm the subject matter expert with analytics, that they come to me for it? And the way you do it is you professionalize yourself and position yourself as best you can. And you can't come in demanding these things without having done that first. And so there's this bit of confidence struggle that happens with analysts I see all the time, where they don't think they're good enough quite yet. And they rely on their chiefs and executives to give them that confidence boost. And I encourage analysts to really find that from within by exercising these strategies, so that nobody is validating you. You are validating you. And so once that's really accomplished and you have a plan set up to really achieve that level of professionalism, that skill development, that working piece, all of that, all along you've been building relationships, you've been providing value. And now if you're not getting what you need, then you can turn around and say, this is what I need to be successful. I do remember, Jason, going into Nashua PD. So I went for my job interview and they said, you know, we want you to be the first person in the state of New Hampshire to build crime analysis. We want you to be that person. And I'm like, awesome. I want to be that person. And then they said, and we're going to give you $40,000 a year to do it. And I was like, so what I did, and this was, you know, gosh, 15 years ago. So that wasn't a bad price for analysis back then, right? Yeah. In the Northeast. But I remember going back to my space and saying to myself, okay, I could say, sure, yeah, and then I'll fix this later, right? This money issue later. Or I could really get some quality language around why it's important that they understand what my vision of success is going to look like. So I sat down and I really pulled my thoughts together on paper and I practiced. And then I went to the person who was hiring me and I said, look, I understand what you want to achieve. You want to build analytical function. And I could tell you how to do that. I know how to build the systems. I know how to build the strategies. I know how to evaluate all of this. I said, but I may not be the right person for you. And they said, what? Why not?
Sounds like it.
Right. And I said, I might not be the best person for you because it sounds like you want to bring someone on at an entry level in terms of pay and in terms of status, right? Because they wanted to like put them under patrol or something like that. Yeah. And I said, to me, best practice would really bring me in as more of a manager level because you're asking me to build something. And it would also... best practice would be for me to be under the chief because of X, Y, and Z reasons. It was a smaller agency, so, you know, 200 officers, so it made sense, right? Mm-hmm. To be under the chief and to how to eliminate some of the hierarchy things that could happen or, you know, the chain of command things that could happen. And I said, so I'm happy to recommend like an earlier level analyst and train them. If you want to hire me as a consultant, I'm happy to train them for you. But if you want me, in order for this to be successful, these are the things that I really do need. And within a couple of days, they bumped up the pay over $10,000. And at the time, that was the highest paid in this region, which was wonderful. Mm-hmm. and they positioned me where I wanted to be positioned. And they brought me on board with invigorated, you know, new excitement, new understanding about what crime analysis really is. And so, you know, I think it's important for us to be verbal about that and to not just say, I want whatever job comes my way, like to really be verbal about the growth that we could help an agency. And if you're an analyst listening to this right now and you don't know the value that you bring as a data-driven strategist, then sit down, write it all out, do some research, listen to some more podcasts and really get a sense of the value that you bring, because accepting whatever comes your way could really be the downfall for a lot of folks. They just want to get in somewhere. And the reality is you got to know what value, what impact you're going to bring to that agency and deliver it.
Yeah. And so then becomes a little bit of pressure though. And you mentioned this again, you mentioned this in your book, this idea that, okay, now got to justify your existence. And it became a weekly event of justify why we just granted you this.
Yeah. Yeah. When I was in New Hampshire, the chief said, this, Don, this is all new to New Hampshire. We don't know about analytics. The agency doesn't know why it's important. He's like, what do you think about documenting this and presenting it at these concept meetings, successes? And at first I was pissed.
I love that answer.
Yeah. At first I was like, what? You know, I thought I had made strides here, right? But then I thought, wow, what an opportunity for me to deliver the intricacies of success here and how analytics can be used effectively and efficiently in these executive meetings. And I was like, whoa, I have this great opportunity. So I figured out this, it was like a little Excel, it was a Word document, but it had three columns and it said, you know, what the problem was, right? And then what crime analysis did and who I collaborated with and what the outcome was. So it was also a great opportunity to highlight other people who were taking advantage of analytics. So I would say something like, the problem is we have a burglary series going on and Detective Osler reached out and said, Don, can you tell me, have you seen any other crimes? You know, what's the pattern look like or whatever? Maybe whatever, I'm making stuff up, right? Mm-hmm. And then I would say in crime analysis, searched these 12 databases, you know, did a thorough analysis, did outreach to regional folks around pattern identification, did some inductive reasoning, did some deductive reasoning, whatever, all of them, right? And yes. Identified, you know, 7 other cases, identified 3 potential suspects, delivered the information to detectives within 24 hours. And within, you know, 48 hours after that, 3 arrests were made and the crime series stopped. So I was able to highlight the detectives, and other people started saying, wait, we didn't know that crime analysis had access to all this stuff. We didn't know that you could tell us where someone's going to hit again. We didn't know that you could make a detective become sergeant because they're clearing all of the burglaries, right? And so we started to create buy-in. So at first I was pretty ticked off, but then I realized the opportunity behind it. And I'm forever thankful for that chief who allowed me to present these successes every single session.
Very good. All right. Well, let's take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about your transition from the police department to creating and finding the Excellence in Analytics. And obviously get into talking about your new book and your advice for analysts.
Beautiful.
This is Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. We'll be right back.
Hello, this is Brian Gray, and my advice for analysts is don't settle for mediocrity. If you want to be happy in this career, long term, you can't be a minimalist. Just don't do what you're asked for. Do what you know is right. And don't ever, ever substitute quantity for quality. And if you haven't found a way to put design to work for you, you're not doing your best work.
Hi, this is Mitri Lewis, and I want to say, make friends with your other analysts. Don't just stay in your own little world, in your own little bubble, but hey, meet the other analysts who work in your jurisdiction, who work in your county, who work in the jurisdictions around you. Have lunch. Go play cards together. Do something together to get to know each other. It will benefit you in the long run.
Welcome back. Don, I want to talk about now the moment you realized that you were leaving the police department and you were establishing your own business and you were creating Excellence in Analytics.
Well, I want to say it was somewhere around 2013 or 11, somewhere around there. I started doing some part-time work for different government entities, right? So I started working for iAtalyst and TxDOT, and I started working for ICP just here and there, right? I started working for some local police agencies who were just like, we need help. We don't need a full-time person, but we just need a little help getting started. So I started taking on these little projects as side projects with TxDOT. They would fly me out to Texas. I would give a presentation that they designed and, you know, I would help the agency, right? Mm-hmm. So build analytical capacity. And so I started doing more and more of these. And what I saw as I started doing this with ICA as well, not the travel, but the teaching, and ICP through CryTech and some other organizations or entities, groups, I started seeing this repeat challenge happen, right? So I'm traveling all over the country and it's progressing and I'm doing a little bit more and more and more as the years go on while I have this full-time job. So I would take vacation and I would go out and teach. So I had 3 weeks vacation, I would go out and teach, right?
Wow.
Or I would do it at home virtually, right? And so I would start to build, have these experiences and do some technical assistance virtually with folks. And the same things were coming up, overworked. The spinning feeling, the I'm so disorganized, I don't know how to even like begin to build analytical capacity, the lack of confidence, the lack of self-care, like all of these issues with supervisors and with the analysts were coming up over and over again. And I was like, you know, what if we just took better care of ourselves? What if I could like insert this injection of inspiration? What if I could just insert this injection of, you don't have to be miserable. Like there's a better way. And so I found that I started having these conversations through these entities that I was working for around inspiring them, right? So we would build their systems. We would talk to the vendors. We would get everything up and running technology-wise. And then it would be lunchtime and I'm filling them with inspiration and filling them with work-life harmony kind of conversations. And I would see them just light up. I would see them call me a week later and like that moment changed me, Don. I would hear them or watch them on Facebook or some other platforms and just see their lives starting to change as a result of some of the conversations we were having. Or they were excited to get back on the call with me. We would have these technical calls and they would say, oh, guess what's happened in my life? And I'm like, oh my God, I love this. So, you know, so I started thinking about how can I create impact in a way that is not technology based, that's not teaching them Access, Excel, fundamentals and all of that. How can I get them inspired? And so I started doing some speaking engagements, really revving people up about their roles in their lives to be the CEOs of their lives and to really design their lives by design. And I loved it. I loved it, loved it, loved it. I would have these conversations more and more. And I found that it just ignited me. It rose me up. And I'm like, you know what? I need to be out of the office doing the analytics and I need to be doing this more and inspiring more and changing lives and shifting lives more. And so several years of quite some time ago now, I threw out this 6-week mind reset program for analysts. And I think I did it for like $500 for 6 weeks of one-on-one coaching and a ton of materials of like templates and all kinds of stuff. Right. Mm-hmm. And I had 6 people join on. It was a summer program. And I was like, change your life. Right. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't know. I don't know if this is going to work, but I feel something drawing me to changing people's lives in this way. With these folks, you know, I saw them go from overwhelm, crying, just feeling undervalued, feeling not respected, to like a massive change in just a few weeks. And I was like blown away. And I knew I needed to do this much, much more. So I left my full-time job full-time. I left it. I was like, see you later, alligator. And it was pretty scary. I started really getting into wellness and body optimization and how to really optimize like the physical body and the emotional body and still be excellent in our work environments, right? Knew how to make people excellent in analytics, right? Which is how I came up with the name. I knew how to make them have systems. I knew how to help them build confidence and, you know, what they should really be doing as an analyst, whatever size agency they're in. I knew that from all my experience with BJ, iAnalyst, ICP, TechSot, and everyone else, right? And so I wanted to really create some tools for them to be successful in their personal life too. And I will say I'm thankful for all of those experiences because I wrote a lot of nationally certified trainings. And so what it really allowed me to do was put structure around the deliverables that we wanted to deliver in the technology side of things, right? Mm-hmm. And so now I had this process that I knew how to do. And so I started creating materials and not nationally certified, but still under that umbrella, you know, following that template. You know, and I built these programs where analysts could learn all of the key things that they needed to learn. They could learn the system stuff. They could learn the technology stuff because I've already done, taught them, could teach them at in different forms. But we built in these other concepts of building the confidence. How do you build your confidence? What specifically can you do to become more confident? Right? How do you build relationships? What is relationship mapping? How does that actually work? And why is it so important? How do you think like a leader? Like all of these concepts that are just not taught in crime analysis 101, right?
Sure. Yeah.
You know, so I spent years just refining it and creating it and reinventing it and seeing people go through the program and seeing people stay in our programs year after year. I was like, oh my God, this is freaking amazing. This is like my life by design. These lives are changing. They're staying. Like nobody leaves. It's so funny. It's Jason. It's like it's so funny because we have the people who were there in the 6 weeks, they're back now.
Yeah.
The people who've gone through the 6-month program have opted into the 12-month program. Right. And so, mm-hmm. And the people in the 12-month program have opted in for another 12 months. Like they don't want to leave because of this amazing community we've built, because of the materials, because of, it's so much more than just knowing how to analyze, right? It's so much more. And so, you know, the transition for me was hard. My first year, I screwed up.
Of course.
I screwed up. I was like, I had this mindset. I was like, this is what I want to do. And I jumped in and I made $30,000 in a year, which is like a third of what I made before. And I was like, oh my God, I'm going to die. Huh? What did I do? So I hired a business coach for a lot of flipping money. And I said, okay, how do I make this an actual business? Because I'm in a government mindset, right? I've worked in policing for 20 plus years. How do I, we're 18 at the time. And so I said, how do I make this into a business? And so I just continued to hire coaches to help me create the business model that I wanted. And I don't think I've ever lived life since then without a coach. I think I've had some kind of coach in my life for the last like 8 or 10 years. Right. And, you know, and I'm still learning and I'm still growing and I have a coach right now. We have a session in 2 weeks, so I can't wait. So I think the transition for me, like I knew something bigger was calling me, and I get reminded of that something bigger every coaching call I'm on, every success that I see our people walking through, every milestone that they're reaching. We had an incredible coaching session last night where the topic was confidence. And we asked the question, like, what are you amazing at? And it was dead silent. I'm like, what? Right. And by the end of this group coaching session, we asked the same question, what are you amazing at? And people were just like, you know what else I'm flipping amazing at? This. And you know what else I can do? This. And it was like this burst of confidence, this burst of energy, and lives were changing. Tears were falling. And you have all these analysts now knowing exactly what they're amazing at. So it's been quite an evolution. We've built on a supervisor component. They have different challenges than analysts have. So we have a supervisor portion and version of what we do as well. So it's been a work in progress. And I'm thankful for all of it. And I'm thankful for my coaches. And I'm thankful for, you know, believing in something and jumping and taking a risk and doing the thing.
Yeah. The risk portion is what I was just thinking about too, because I don't know if you have real growth without risk. Mm-hmm. And you talked about risk and you talked about the idea of failure. Mm-hmm. And I think the fear of failure is what cripples many of us. I'm in that same boat as well. So I'm not throwing stones in a glass house kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But for you, I admire what you did. You talked about the first year being really rough. And I think your mindset was, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, it's not what training or product I need. It's what person can help me. Mm-hmm. And there's a distinction there. I think with you reaching out to your life coaches and having that relationship and having them talk through and customizing your particular situation, instead of buying something that's off the shelf or some kind of knowledge or book or anything like that, I think that was key to your success.
Absolutely. So there's two important things that you're talking about here, the fear of failure and the coach piece. With the coach piece, I am a huge reader, right? I read and read and read, but there's only so much that books can get you. There's only so far that they can get you. It's the application, it's the customization, it's the different set of binoculars, right, that you can see through. And so, yes, hiring a coach, to me, I paid $6,000 for my first coach, and I like cried. I was like, oh my God, what did I just do? Like, this is crazy. And, you know, and since I hired that $6,000 coach, I've never, ever been under six figures. And so I'm like, okay, so who's my next coach? What level do I want to get to? You know? And so we don't see it sometimes, right? We don't see the value until we get to the other side. And now that I know what the value is at the other side, I jump on the right coach. I mean, it can't be any coach. It has to be the right coach. And so I don't live my life without a coach now at all. I mean, why? Why make your journey harder? You know, invest in yourself so that you can accelerate and get the results that you want faster. Do your research, find the right coach, but invest in yourself so that you can get there faster, whether it's meal planning, whether it's health and wellness, whether it's analytics, whether it's being a leader, like whatever it is that your goal is. For me, it was understanding business, which was not something I understood before I built my own business, right? I was a consultant. That was it. The government paid me. I was a consultant. I got paid, right? That was the end of that. But I didn't understand how to hire people. I didn't understand how to nourish people and all of those things. And so my other coach that I hired after that, that was triple that price, which I almost died when I did that too, but I did it, you know? And so that's why I think coaching for me is so important to deliver as well, because I know what's on the other side. So that's the first piece, that coaching piece. The other piece, that fear of failure piece, is so prevalent to so many people. It's so hard for so many people. But I bring this example up to my clients a ton. And I say, the woman who developed Spanx, right? Her dad, you know, would ask her once a week, what did you do to fail this week?
Huh.
Yeah. What did you do to fail this week? Because if you didn't fail, whatever you tried was not big enough. And he shifted her mindset on what failure means. I look for opportunities, period, right? Mm-hmm. If I'm looking for 100 opportunities, I'm probably going to fail at 60 of them. But those 40 opportunities are going to fly, right? They're going to be amazing. And so I do the same thing with my daughter. You know, and I say to her, she's 11 or 10, she'll be 11 in just a few weeks. And I'll say to her, what did you fail at this week? And she's like, well, I tried this math problem and I got frustrated and I failed 4 times before I succeeded, right? Before mm-hmm. I finally figured it out. I'm like, beautiful. If everything flows to you so easily, you know, you're not testing your boundaries, then it's not big enough. And if you're testing your boundaries and you're feeling depleted and you're feeling failure, like, is suffocating you and, oh, I failed, like, that's also a tough spot to be in. But when you shift your mindset and say, in order for me to succeed, I probably have to fail 9 times. So I'm going to try 10 different things because one of them is going to result in something positive.
One of the questions I want to ask you is, you're helping people, man, do we just get in our way of ourselves? It's attitude and effort. What do you find with analysts in particular? They just struggle with, and especially in the beginning of your program.
Yeah, I would say analysts and supervisors struggle with 2 major things. One is confidence. I think 9.5 out of 10 people who come through our programs, they're struggling with confidence. Am mm-hmm. I doing enough? Are my products good enough? They don't like me. All of that. And then I think they also struggle with work-life harmony and what they want that to look like in their lives. A lot of times they feel like they have to sit at a desk all day and they have to be answering phone calls at 10 at night or, you know, in order to provide quality and provide value. That often disrupts their home lives. It often really makes it so that 90% of their focus is work and they struggle at home. They struggle with stress a lot. That's one of the biggest things. And so the vision of a better life is one of the biggest challenges. They just don't know where to start. And that's exactly what module 1 is all about. It's about creating clarity on the life that you desire. And some people have never been asked this question. Like, they've never been asked the question of, what do you want your life to look like? They've never been told that if you're stressed out, if you're overwhelmed, if you're working 90 hours a week, it's because you decided that. And they're like, wait, no, I didn't. My boss decided that for me, or they make this happen. And I'm like, you decided that. You decided that that's the life that you want. And you also have the ability to decide if that's not the life you want. You can design it exactly the way that you want it to be. And so that, to me, is the wow moment for a lot of folks, because they just didn't imagine that they had that kind of power over their lives.
I'm laughing now and smiling because it makes me think of my mom. She would always say, well, Jason's making me do this. Mm-hmm. Trying to help her out. And then she would tell everybody, well, Jason's making me do this kind of thing. Not that I really want to, but Jason's making me do it. So,
right. Exactly. And analysts are exactly the same way. Supervisors especially, because they feel the crunch. They feel the crunch from the uppers. They feel the crunch to protect their analysts. They're the ones who are working a lot of overtime hours. They're the ones that are bringing work home on a Sunday so that Mondays will be easier. Bull. I think when people start to understand that they get to design it any way they want, at that moment, they're like, well, what do you mean? How do I do that? What do I want? What do I want? Right. And so we have tools and templates and coaching that gets them through all facets of their life. What do you want your spiritual life to look like? You know, what do you want your connection to earth look like, right? Or church or whatever spiritual denomination you belong to. What do you want your career to look like here now and 10 years from now? What does that feel like, look like, taste like to you? What do you want your relationships to look like with your family. I mean, we've worked with people. I had a client who started back in March, I want to say. And she said, I have no relationship with my husband anymore. I don't even know who he is. My kids don't like me. They're older now, right? My kids don't like me. And so all of my energy goes to work because that's what I'm good at. And that's where I feel valued. And then work becomes an issue. And now she's like, who the flip am I? Yeah. I'm not happy at work. I'm not happy at home. What the heck is going on? And I see that pattern with people so often that it's easier to do work well. So they'll put their energy into work. And then as soon as, and really neglect some other areas of their lives that are worthy of attention. And then work will have something happen, right? And they're like, what? And everything starts crumbling down. I've given so much to this job and everything crumbles down. And so with that particular client, we worked through a health history, really, you know, wellness history and an understanding of where she wanted to go with her family. What does it look like to have a healthy relationship with her sons and her husband? And how does that feel? Really spent a lot of time doing that, almost a month doing that. And once she was clear on what she wanted that to look like, I mean, she's like, oh, I guess, you know, we'll talk to each other every once in a while. Like, at least they'll say hi to me. I'm like, let's fight for more. What do you really, really want? Right. Yeah. And so once she defined what she really wanted, we create these inspired action steps every single week for her to accomplish, to move the needle closer to that goal. Yeah. And so I'm so happy to report back that she has completed our program, our wellness coaching program, and has found so much love of life right now. She's been on multiple vacations with her family and actually enjoyed it. She has rekindled her relationship with her husband that was distant because of all the energy she was putting into work. She's gotten more organized at work relative to analytics and job responsibilities. And now she goes out with her girlfriends. She feels really good about the love that she's pouring into herself, that self-peace that's happening. And she enjoys her life. And she'll be the first person to say, oh, I'm still a work in progress. And we all are, right? But watching her shift from this hole that she had put herself in to deciding that she's no longer going to be there to investing in herself. And that was a hard thing. She's like, Dawn, this is hard for me to put money in myself. And I'm like, yeah, and time. Don't forget, you have to be here. And it's hard. It is hard. But now she's on the other side of it. And she's like, oh my Lord, why didn't I do this sooner? It's up to you to create your best life. And if they say, how are you so flippin' happy? You've had the same chaos in your life that I've had in mine. How are you happy about this? You know, my response to people all the time is because I've decided. Yeah. You know, I've decided that I want a better life. I've decided that I'm not going to be the typical teen mom in Lawrence on welfare in, you know, getting food stamps. And I needed that at that point in my life. So there's no disrespect to anyone who's there, but I knew that that's not what I wanted for the rest of my life. I decided to leave a terrible relationship, right? Even though I put myself there, I decided that that was not going to be my life anymore. I decided that I was going to write a book. I was like, holy cow, I guess I'm gonna, right? And so like, we can decide to show up as our best selves, and that evolves and that changes, and that work is constant, right? Which is why I always have a coach in my life.
I know you've mentioned it several times. You've kind of weaved it in there, but I wanted to make sure before I move on that I make sure that we've answered your question, what your advice would be for our listeners.
I would say, you know, I suppose the number one thing is leadership of self. That has to be your priority. Stop trying to fix everybody else. Leadership of self has to be your priority. It's literally the most important thing you can do. That self-love, that self-care, that was not something that was obvious to me. I always was like, fight, fight, fight. The rewards will come later. Fight, fight, fight. But they never came, right? Until I shifted and said, self-love and self-care needs to happen first. Leadership of self must be the priority. Becoming your best self really involves optimizing multiple areas in your life, right? It means saying to yourself, what do I want my life to look like? Do I want to have massages? Do I want to have quiet time under a tree? Do I want to have exercise in my life? Do I want to have hiking? Like, what do I want my life to look like? What's going to fuel my body? What's going to fuel my spirit? What's going to fuel my mind? And how can I create this life that I love to live and provide these high quality services in law enforcement analytics, right? When we decide that this is our motto, I am the CEO of my life, When we decide that that's the motto, then we are knowing that we come first, and it's not selfish. It is a way of life. When you're on an airplane, you do not put, you know, the mask on the person next to you first. In order for you to deliver your best self, your best services, you have to put the mask on yourself first. And what that means for me is it means yoga. I actually broke my back at one point. And it means that when I don't do yoga, when I don't stretch out, when I put on extra weight, it hurts. It hurts my back. And then I'm cranky, right? Yeah. So leadership of self for me means optimizing my body, putting quality nutrition in it that's really going to heal my back. There's a lot of science behind what food and nutrition can do for your body. I'm actually graduating from the Institute of Integrative Nutrition in a couple weeks. And so over the past year, I've been learning in like an actual program, but years before that, learning on my own what nutrition can do for my body and what stress reduction can do for my body and what it cannot do, right? And so for me, it means I'm going to bed by 10 o'clock at night. I'm getting up every morning and I'm having some tea by myself when no one else is awake so that I could, you know, infuse my body with matcha and chaga. I'm into some mushrooms right now. I know if Rhea is listening to this, she's going to hate it, but I'm telling you there's medicinal benefits of that. And I fuel my body in a way that optimizes it. And I get my yoga in, which is power yoga for me usually. And I know that sets me up for success. I look at my day and I say to myself, how can I optimize myself? How can I be intentional about, you know, success today? And I define my three things that I want to achieve that day. So when I do this, when I put myself first, when I, you know, have my tea, when I go to bed early for some people, when I say no, when I create quality boundaries, when I put into my schedule. So here's a quick tip. So if you're trying to figure out leadership of self, every Friday, I write out my schedule of goals for the next week. So I have my big picture goals that I want to achieve. And every week I write out my small goals that are going to lead me to those bigger ones, right? So the first thing that goes into my schedule is leadership of self. So yoga is in there for the week, period. Like every day, it's just in there. And then I start building in these other things into my schedule. What hike do I want to go on? What massage do I want to get? What friends do I want to connect with? What books do I want to read? And I build that into my schedule first. That's leadership of self as a priority. And I don't negotiate those things. That's my time. And then I build in all the work assignments and all the laundry and all the different things that have to happen. But that would be my number one advice for analysts. Hold leadership of self as your top priority.
Good. Well, this leads us to your book, which we've buried that lead long enough.
Yeah.
And Bigger Than Data, when did you decide to write the book and how long did it take you?
So that's a great question, because for years I was just collecting these stories. I was writing. I'm like, oh, someday. And there's, Jason, where my fear came in, like, who am I to write a book, right? So I was just collecting these stories and kind of things that would come into my mind. I would keep it in this Word document and I would just type it up and no grammar, no connect, like nothing professional. I would just like kind of throw these ideas in here and I printed them out and I put them in this little folder and I would just kind of revisit it every once in a while. I was like, oh, I had a really cool story and I threw it in there. Or, oh my God, everyone's struggling with data quality. Like, and so I started writing some ideas around that. I just kind of had this pile going of random stuff. And then last June, this wonderful person who was in my life looked at me and he says, where's your book? I was like, what? I was like, what? And he says, a woman like you writes a book. And I was like, I do?
Never thought of it.
Right. I was like, what do you mean a woman like me? Right. Like, what does that mean? And I didn't see myself in that light. And it was always like a someday when I'm mature or someday when the someday thing. Right. Mm-hmm. And, so I started doing a little research and I found this publicist / everything who says, write your book in 12 weeks. And I was like, bull.
You like, write a book in 12 weeks.
Right. I was like, no flipping way. But I had already developed the Rising Genius program. So I had material, I had language, I had videos, I had all these things. They were just kind of everywhere. Right. Mm-hmm. And then I had all these stories tucked away that I was kind of just, you know, not very organized about. They were just there. Right. So I was like, you know, I'm going to get on the call. So I got on a call with them and they said, yes, that's exactly what we do. We help entrepreneurs put their thoughts together and write a book. Oh. And so I was like, oh my God. And it's $15,000 to do. So I was like, what? $15,000. Oh my God. And I just took another risk. And I was like, okay, I'm in. And I don't have $15,000 floating around. Like that wasn't, I was just like, and it was scary. And I was just like, but I always invest in the business, probably around $20,000 a year that put aside. And I always say, okay, what am I going to do? What coach am I going to have? What business trips am I going to go on? I'm flying out to Arizona next week. That's part of this, to speak to the analytical group out there. So I did that same thing in Florida. I flew out there. So, to me, I always have this money set aside of like, how am I going to invest in the business? Right. And I was like, all right, how am I going to invest in the business this year? And I said, I'm going to write the book. So I handed over $15,000. I was like, oh, and they were wonderful. They were wonderful. They got me organized. They actually do some ghostwriting, but I didn't want that. I really wanted to write it myself. So, so I had probably 450 pages of material that were somewhat written in a blog over here, in my program over there, in that little pile of papers over here.
Yeah.
And I gave it to them and they like narrowed this thing down to less than 200 pages. And I was like, oh no, the fears started kicking in. Like, that's not the full message. And we got to pull that out. And I wrote about my ex and how devastating that relationship was and how that really ignited a lot of my own transformation. And I provided detail about what it was like to be in an abusive relationship. And then I ripped it all out of the book. I was like, oh no, too soon for that. And so there was this process of waking up super early and getting it done and, deciding what was right for the book and what was not right for the book. And I trusted the company quite a bit to just tell me, how to maximize all those 400 something pages and how to make that happen. And they did in 12 weeks. We did it. We pulled it all together. I don't flippin' know how, but we did. And then we came out with this book and I have to say, Jason, it was like a whirlwind. I'm so thankful for the connections that I had built throughout the years because I was really able to say, hey, I'm on this new adventure. I wrote this book. And I think that if we get it into the hands of analysts, it could really change their lives. The concepts in it have changed the lives of so many analysts and supervisors who are in our programs right now. And this is just a snippet of it, but I feel like it could change their lives. And I said, we're having a big launch in October. I want this to get in as many hands as possible. All of these people who had been in my life at one point or another just came together. I was so thankful. They just came together and they bought the book and they, shared it with other people. I had chiefs saying, can I buy 20? Because I want to give them to my analysts as a gift of their value. I want to help nourish their hearts and their souls and their analytical capacity and their wellness all in one. I'm like, perfect. That's what the book does. So we did. We launched and within 5 hours, I want to say, we became bestseller on 10 different platforms in Amazon, which was like mind-blowing for me. We got the banner, which I guess is a big deal. I didn't know any of these things, right? But we got the banner. And what that tells me is the industry is shifting. The industry is shifting. We are understanding that law enforcement analytics, military analytics, it's all being more and more professionalized at this point. It's being more professionalized. It's coming into colleges now as a degree. It's chiefs are acknowledging that analysts matter. To me, this is a shift. Christopher Bruce shifted our culture way back when. And now it's another shift, right? And, the work that you do and all of the things that are happening around the industry as a whole are just completely shifting. And this book in more analysts' hands are going to give them the confidence to ask for that pay raise and get it. It's going to give them the relationship building strategies that they need. It's going to give them the things that they need to further professionalize the field so that 5-10 years from now, no analyst is going to get paid 50 grand. Like analysts should be paid 100 grand, which I guess it depends on what part of the world you're listening in on this. But here in the Northeast, I see analysts getting paid 40, 50 grand and they're professionals. And I'm just like, hey, no, demand more. Let's do this together as a unit, as an industry to really get ourselves positioned so well that we are recognized. If we went to the public sector, we'd be starting off at $125, right?
The private sector.
I'm sorry, the private sector. Yes, yeah. Exactly. And so this is an opportunity for this industry as a whole. IACA has given opportunity to professionalize. I think they just announced their 100th certified analyst. I want to see it at 1,000. I want to see it at 1,000. Every analyst should be seeking certification, right? And so, so we have opportunities to professionalize ourselves. Let's do it together as a larger community so that we can rise it all to just this higher level where nobody will be offering you $40,000, $50,000. Everyone will be saying, we need you. We value you. You're not in a box. You're not in a little teeny spot. You're part of our, you're fully integrated into our agency and you are so valued. That's what I think we can do. And that's what I think the book can do for our law enforcement community.
Yeah, I do see the shift, especially in the idea of self-care and acknowledging that the law enforcement analyst job can be stressful and see a lot of shit. I've had Trina Cook on now, and I just had Shauna Gibson on there talking about their role in their department and dealing with people psychologically, mentally. So I'm partway through the book. I was trying to find the words of how I would describe it. And here's what I will say thus far for me. The book is like meeting someone from your hometown. And so there's a lot of familiar lingo and references that I instantly connect with. But I don't know that I don't necessarily know the book. I can't predict the book or anything like what's going to happen next. But it's fascinating to me because everything is familiar, but strangely new. And for me, it's twofold. Obviously, the advice on law enforcement analysis is something I can relate to because I spent 10 years in the profession. But the second way is I spent a lot of time listening. Unlike you, I don't like to read. So I did a lot of books on tape. So I would listen to a lot of the leadership advice. So you reference, you know, folks like Dale Carnegie and Stephen Covey, Dave Ramsey, and I listened to The Wealthy Barber and Rich Dad, Poor Dad. Mm-hmm. So it was so familiar to me. Very nostalgic yet new.
Wonderful. Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah. Dale Carnegie, Napoleon Hill. And if you're listening to books, I think I do too. I listen to books too, because how much can we read? I always have a notebook with me as I'm listening to jot down these action steps that I want to take. So I value the fact that you're listening to books. I think that's wonderful. And the leadership piece, John Maxwell, there's so many great leadership instructors out there. We actually have a YouTube and a whole section on leadership and leadership development. We have our 4-Minute Fridays, which are always about leadership development. And we teach, and we have a leadership RG program where we have supervisors and leaders come in. We have guest speakers. And so having something that's familiar, that's igniting you is wonderful. And having it have some new thoughts and new concepts that bring you to some other authors or some other programming, I think is wonderful too. So thank you for taking the time to read it, Jason. I appreciate you.
I'll get through it eventually. It'll just take me a while.
Well, I was thinking about making it an audio. What would it mean for me? And it would mean 8 hours of talking. So maybe I'll do that on my computer instead of with a publicist to just make it available. So folks like you and me, I enjoy the listening part of it too. There's some great podcasts on leadership as well that I personally listen to. I love Lewis Howes. So if you're looking for new folks, new library of people, I'm happy to help. Yes.
Very good. And I do recommend it on the Kindle, which is fantastic because you do put links, hyperlinks in the text to more information. And so that's very helpful. As I'm reading in the Kindle, I can tap that and download the PDF, the extra documents that you put into the book.
And it's funny because like I am not an ebook reader at all. So kudos to you. Like I need a marker. I need a pen. I'm scribbling in the books. So I applaud you for reading online. And yes, there's a ton of links in there. We have a program website that lists all of our programs, as well as a bunch of free downloads that are directly from the book. So analyst mantras, what that portfolio is, or like how to develop your own portfolio. We even provide you with a template that you can just download and use as your own portfolio. And there's, I don't know, maybe a dozen free resources in there for analysts. And it's just scratching the surface. Like in our actual program, we give you ComSat templates, we give you annual report templates, we give you all kinds of different templates that make your life a lot easier too.
obviously, I highly recommend the book to our listeners, and we'll put links in the show notes how you can get access to the book and get access to Dawn's program.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
All right. So I do want to move on. I wanted to take the time to congratulate you on winning the IACA Brian Hill Service Award. You beat me out, you punk.
Thank you. I will say I was scared. I was like, oh my gosh, this is Jason. He's amazing. I think next year you own this.
Well, geez, I made them this wonderful montage of his career to play out. I flew out to make sure that I got there right before the awards, and then they don't give it to me. But that's just the bitterness talking.
Well, I will say, if I can pause us for a moment here, when I think about the leaders in industry, when I think about the Deb Peels and the Christopher Bruces, I think about you. I think about you spending your time, your energy, collecting people, having these interviews, this podcast. And I see you as one of the movers, one of the shifters in our law enforcement analytical culture. And so regardless of the award recipient, I think that you are well deserving of this and many other rewards, Jason. The work you do is so valuable.
Thank you for saying that. It's funny. And I don't know if I don't think I'm alone in this. But right then and there, I started to get cringy. Mm. When you started talking positive about me and... I started to cringe a little bit and become uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And it was funny. We had an award ceremony at work a couple weeks back, and one of my coworkers won an award, and our manager talked about him for probably like 2 or 3 minutes. But mm-hmm. to me, it was uncomfortable, and it was way too long, even though it was only 2 or 3 minutes. And I thought, well, if I ever win that, I want you to talk about 30 seconds. Give me, whatever it is, I'm uncomfortable with you talking positive about me. I mean, so that's just good stuff. Like, then you got to be comfortable talking about the bad stuff. And that gets me to my next question with you is just that you bring up stuff in the book that is obviously uncomfortable. Yeah. And stuff that's really hard to talk about. And you talked about the idea of being a perfectionist, getting over that idea and letting people know that you're not perfect.
I think it's so easy for us to point out what we're not good at, right? It's harder for us to identify with what value we bring to the table because we feel like, oh, we're bragging, or we feel like, whatever it might be. But when we own what value we bring, we're not relying on anyone else, and we're not selfish or egocentric or any of that. We're defining the value that we're bringing so that we can bring it more. Right. And so we do get uncomfortable in the book. I definitely had issues with being a perfectionist. I mean, I was the person from the beginning of this conversation that had to be perfect. I had already gotten pregnant as a sophomore in college. I had already, I could never be the person. They're like, oh, we knew it. She was just going to be, a loser. I was so set on being perfect and doing nothing wrong that it stumped my growth, quite honestly, because if I was able to, fully express the fears, fully express the successes, and fully express the challenges in an articulate way and in a way that, invited people to hear and to help, then I probably would have seen more joy earlier. It is challenging for people to highlight themselves. And that's why I really encourage analysts to take every opportunity they have to highlight the analyst next to them and the supervisor next to them, because it is something that we truly struggle with. I talked a little bit about our session the other night on confidence, or last night on confidence in our group, when I said, what value do you bring? What are you amazing at? And this one woman just started bawling her eyes out because she had let the noise in of what other people were telling her was wrong with her. And that's a sad place to be. Luckily, our group corralled and we were able to really articulate well what she was amazing at. And she walked away like flying, right? Flying high. But I think this is a practice that analysts really need to get into. That's why I started that portfolio piece, to really highlight and get used to articulating what we're good at. Bringing us back to that story about that chief who said, prove yourself. I was like, what? then I wanted to just highlight everybody else, but I had to really reel it in and say, Dawn, you know, here's an opportunity for you to educate people on the value that you do bring, you know, and get that buy-in and that influence that you're looking for. So let's maximize this opportunity. And I think the same is true for you, Jason. You know, it can feel weird and awkward in the beginning to reveal any of these vulnerabilities, right? Mm-hmm. But it is really important that we are so clear on what we deliver, because then we can focus on where the gaps exist. But if we're only focused on the gaps, that really depletes us as a human, right? And that leaves us stuck in certain mindsets and really certain habits that are not leading us to our best lives. So yes, it feels uncomfortable for two to three minutes of somebody telling you how amazing you are, right? And so I think about what these conversations of recognition, you need it, Jason. You need this too. I need this sometimes because, man, I take a lot of risks and I fall on my face. And there's a lot of people who could be like, oh, I hate this chick. Like, who is she? I hate her voice. I hate everything about her. Right. And that's okay. Like, you know, those things happen. But I think we do need to remind ourselves of what we are incredible at so that we can become more incredible, right, at that and clearly identify the gaps and not just see ourselves as deficient.
So what's next for Dawn Reby?
Well, I will say I'm considering book two and three right now.
Sequels.
Sequels. One for supervisors. And then in analytics, I teach a supervisor class through ISCA. And I teach, we have our leadership program. And it's really for all industry, social sector industry, not just law enforcement, on the leadership level. So I want to grow that. I really think that there's so much value to teaching the stepping stones to those leadership opportunities and the leadership core characteristics of leadership of life as well. So for me, next steps, I want to grow this business. I want to hire more coaches. I hired my fifth person and I'm so happy and excited. I want to hire 10 more people. I want to have this company, Excellence in Analytics. I want it to really be positioned so that, you know, chiefs are calling us up more than they are right now and saying, Dawn, who can you send me? If they go through your program, we know that they're well-rounded, that they're contributors, and supervisors too. Like, I want supervisors knowing that this is where you learn how to be that amazing leader that you want to be. And I feel very fortunate of where we are right now, but I want BJA, I want Crytek, I want ISCP, I want other folks to really to understand the bigger picture of it all and to offer these opportunities at a federal level. And so that's really where we're going. So if you know of any great coaches out there, I would love to have more people on our team serving the analytical community, the law enforcement community, and the fire EMS community as well. And it fills my heart to see it unfold. It fills my heart to look at these coaches that we do have and know that their lives are better. And I want more. I want more of that, Jason. I want so much more. I want more energy around analytics. I want more money for our analysts. I want more prestige for our analysts. What's next for Dawn? Oh gosh, this is like all of it. All of it is next. It's next for Dawn. It's next for the analytical community. It's happening. It's happening right now. So that's what's next for me.
Excellent. All right. Well, our last segment of the show is Words to the World. And this is where I give the guest the last word and you can promote any idea that you wish. Dawn, what are your words to the world?
Be the CEO of your life. Be the CEO of your life. Decide what you really, really want. I mean, what you really want is where you are right now, where you want to be, right? And if not, where do you want to be? How do you want to feel? What do you want to do right now? Who do you want to be? Don't have to struggle with a lack of self-care or boundaries or a stressful lifestyle. You can absolutely be the best version of yourself. You just have to decide that you are the CEO of your life.
Very good. Well, I leave every guest with, you've given me just enough to talk bad about you later.
Wonderful.
But I do appreciate you being on the show, Dawn. Thank you so much, and you be safe.
Thank you, Jason. I appreciate you.
Thank you for joining us today on Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. We hope you not only enjoyed the show, but also learned something new. For more information on our guests and information relating to today's topic, please visit our website at leapodcast.com. Special thanks to The Rough and Tumble for our theme song. For more of their music, you can visit their website at theroughandtumble.com. Also, thanks to Kyle McMullen for our show logo. For more of his design, please visit his website at moderntype.com. The show is hosted, recorded, and edited by Jason Alder and written by me, Mindy. You can contact us both via the LEA podcast website. Please join us again next time as we interview another expert in this great field.